I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. The Milwaukee Biz Times had a front page story, The Trump Factor, business leaders hopeful that he will boost the economy. And we thought that would make for a good conversation. And so that's what we're talking about this hour of the program. We have two guests with us. Michael Kinetter is president and CEO of the Wisconsin Foundation and Alumni Association, past dean of the University of Wisconsin School of Business, former senior staff economist for former President George Herbert Walker Bush, and also for Bill Clinton. He was interviewed extensively in this article. And Michael, we thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Also joining us is Kurt Bauer. Kurt is president and CEO of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, an organization that's been around for more than a century, and it represents 3,800 employers of all sizes and from every sector of the economy. He previously spent 18 years working for financial industry trade groups, including serving as CEO for both the Wisconsin and Arizona Bankers Associations. Kurt, thank you so much for being with us. Hello.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
Yeah, very nice to have you here. Let's start with the stock market. I don't know if it's all related to what's happening in the state of Wisconsin, but it's really hit a record high and has been at a very, very good number ever since Donald Trump took over. Were there promises that the president made during the campaign that made businesses think things are going to be good under him? Michael, you want to start?
Sure. I think the early optimism is probably directly tied to the fact that people just believe a Trump administration will be much more pro-business, given his background, than, say, the Obama administration. And I think, you know, it's kind of fair to say that Trump would be more trusting of producers and consumers to figure things out on their own, whereas Obama's administration might have been more inclined to say consumers might need to be protected from producers. And we see that probably most in financial sector and energy. And those are the two sectors that really drove a big share of the recovery in stock prices or growth in stock prices since the election.
Mm-hmm. And I know in a survey of your membership, Kurt, that 78% of respondents were either optimistic or very optimistic about what a Trump presidency would mean for business.
You know, it's interesting that the survey you just mentioned was from right after the election. We went into the field with our membership right after the election and through December and released it to the media in January. We survey our membership twice per year. So the last one we did was during the summer, and we did a straw poll. And it was interesting because there was a lot of uncertainty about the Trump candidacy. More of our members supported him than they did Hillary Clinton, but not nearly to the percent that they did 4 years ago with Romney, because Romney was a known entity to them. He had served in public office, whereas Trump, of course, has not. Still, there's a tremendous amount of optimism starting the year with him for many of the reasons that Dr. Kinetter mentioned. They saw Hillary Clinton as a third term of Barack Obama. Frankly, they probably thought that she would have to shift a little bit to the left because of the Bernie Sanders factor. So they're optimistic, despite the fact that Donald Trump did not provide a lot of details during the campaign other than on tax policy. And, you know, the first week, they're pleased with what they've seen on at least the energy front and some of the rhetoric. Some of the other things might be a little more concerning on the trade front. But overall, our members start the year very optimistic, and I think you're seeing that reflected in the stock market.
Mm-hmm. And, Michael, what do you think is the most important thing the president-elect could do in his, and maybe he's already done it, in his first 100 days in office?
Well, if we're talking about economics, you know, the positive opportunities, I guess, would include something like an infrastructure bill that could focus on maybe improving our transportation network across the board, whether it's highways, rail, bridges, ports, airports, all those things. You know, and that really does two things. It can boost the long-term productivity of the country, but it also puts people into construction jobs right away, and it's probably that blue-collar labor that maybe has suffered the most in the last 25 or 30 years in relative terms, both because of competitive pressures caused by trade, but also the steady march of technology that is an alternative to using, you know, less skilled labor in producing things.
And Kurt, I know Michael has suggested that there might be a possibility of public-private partnerships in this whole area. Do you think that's a good idea?
On the transportation front?
Right, on infrastructure.
Well, yeah, I think there is some optimism there. I certainly think that we need some investment at the state level, at the national level. The road condition isn't where it needs to be, and for a state like Wisconsin, we're a manufacturing state, we're an agricultural state, we're a tourism state, the common denominator there is that you need good roads to move people around and move goods around. So I think that that makes a lot of sense, and we're particularly encouraged by the prospect of pairing that with tax reform, because one of the things that has been floated that you do some sort of tax reform, you do something that encourages repatriation of funds that have been captured or are stuck abroad because of the punitive tax to bring them back in and use that revenue for infrastructure spending. I think that that could be bipartisan, although my understanding is that the congressional retreat in Philadelphia last week, that did not receive a lot of attention or a lot of the Republicans didn't embrace that as much as they should. I think the business community would like something like that.
Mm-hmm. What about the corporate tax rate? What are his plans? And I'm wondering what both of you think about that. And will those indeed become a reality? He's going to cut the tax pretty significantly, Mike?
Potentially, it's being discussed. And I think, you know, the hope is that lower corporate taxes would provide stronger incentives for companies to base their activity here. And certainly at the margin, I guess, you know, I see no reason why that wouldn't help. That would be one factor in a firm's location decision. So, that could help. It depends on what kind of bill could be passed. Tax bills are always a little trickier to pass than people imagine, but probably some corporate tax changes are maybe more likely to get through than major reforms to personal income tax.
Hmm. And if they did get through, they would result in what, Kurt? Lower taxes would result in...
I think you would see greater economic activity as a result. We're 35% corporate tax rate, which is the highest in the industrialized world. If you compare that to China at 25%, the UK at 20%, Canada at 15%, and I believe Ireland is 12.5%. So you can see that we're an outlier, and it really discourages investment here in the United States. And we've seen that here with Johnson Controls and the inversion that took place to Ireland because they have a lower corporate tax rate. It's a perverse incentive for businesses to move elsewhere. So I think that if you lower the corporate tax rate, if you make it more competitive, you're going to see more investment here in the United States. And this could be done on a bipartisan basis because you have had Democrats who have talked about the fact that we do have the highest corporate tax rate. And during the campaign here in Wisconsin against Senator Johnson and Russ Feingold never put out a percentage of what he'd like to see it lower to, but he did say that he thought that the U.S. rate was too high and it needed to come down.
Mm-hmm. And what percentage of the federal budget is dependent on corporate taxes, Michael?
I think it's about 10%. No, maybe 15%. Yeah, but it's not a huge percentage of our tax revenue, and so you could introduce a substantial cut without causing a huge amount of damage because, of course, you know, say you cut it in half, maybe you'd lose 7% of the revenues, federal revenues, but 5 to 7%. But you'd make some of that up by just having more activity potentially. That wouldn't be an immediate huge effect, but over time could help change that. And you'd get more personal tax revenue as well to the extent there's more investment here and jobs created. So it doesn't have to be a loser, that's for sure. And, so that is an area that could be improved. And, you know, one thing that might happen when there are tax cuts like that, it doesn't necessarily go into the pockets of any particular workers, but it would create more jobs. And, you know, it's hard to predict who gets them, but it's not just a windfall for executives per se.
Mm-hmm. So you could still do that, let's say cut them in half and still do a major infrastructure program? It wouldn't take that much away from the federal budget?
Yeah, well, you know, the public-private partnerships that have been discussed, you know, it's an interesting idea. I mean, there are opportunities to give private companies an incentive to invest money in infrastructure, provided they can get some of the revenue that's generated by the infrastructure, you know, in the form of tolls at bridges or on roads or whatever the case might be. So, you know, I think there are ways of doing that. What the key is, can you find pools of capital to make these investments and then maybe pay for them with some combination of not just current public dollars, but user fees that provide the incentive for private capital to flow to the project as well.
Certainly for many years, Kurt, let's start with you on this. We've heard that businesses have just terribly onerous regulations. President Trump has talked about businesses being subjected to unnecessary regulations for some time. What are some of those? Can everybody agree on what the regulations are that maybe we could do away with?
Well, let me, you know, I'll say one thing, and then I'll let Kurt talk about it.
Okay.
He would know more of the details in some of the sectors in Wisconsin. But, you know, just think about getting a mortgage yourself or buying a car.
Mm-hmm.
Last time I bought a car, I can't remember how many pieces of paper I had to sign.
Right.
I mean, basically, the guy sits there and says, oh, this is what this says, and, you know, nobody reads it, and you just sign it. But it's, you know, I think I signed 30 pieces of paper. Think about that. That's to buy a car, and that's crazy. And so there are things like that that I think get out of hand, and any given Congress, you know, these people aren't generally running companies. They wouldn't see that, and they're around when they pass a few incremental laws, and they think it's no big deal. But, you know, after a period of time, it can get to be a really big deal.
How's the car? Do you like the car?
That's okay. I don't buy fancy cars, Kathleen.
Yeah, I don't either, but getting another one is always a big deal in my life. Michael.
Well, just building on what Dr. Kinetter said, the cumulative effect is overwhelming. You know, Heritage Foundation came out with an estimate that there were 20,642 new regulations passed during the Obama administration, and the American Enterprise Institute estimates that that costs about $2 trillion, with a T, $2 trillion for businesses to comply on an annual basis. That is a lot of money being diverted away from the productive economy, away from R&D, away from mergers and acquisitions, away from hiring. And, you know, just to go back to your question, some of the specifics, you know, certainly the Affordable Care Act has been signaled out by my membership in all of the surveys that we have done. Healthcare costs have been going up, and they largely blame Obamacare for that. And that's a huge cost of doing business for them. The EPA has been very tough here in Wisconsin. We're a manufacturing-intensive economy, which means we need energy. And the EPA has been tough because they have been trying to shut down fossil fuels, and Wisconsin's energy generation is dependent on coal. The National Labor Relations Board, Dodd-Frank, which is interesting in a manufacturing economy like ours, Conflict Minerals, which has nothing to do with the financial sector, yet that was included in that massive piece of legislation. And then on the worker side, you know, we've looked at the overtime rule, which has now been suspended, but, you know, that would have constituted a huge cost of increasing the cost of hiring. And, again, a perverse incentive. We want to encourage businesses to hire more. We don't want to make it more expensive. If you make it more expensive, you get less of it.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the Affordable Care Act, there is a great deal of worry among Democrats and Republicans that there isn't something in place or in somebody's mind that's been put in the minds of Americans that's going to replace the Affordable Care Act and be much better than it. Michael, do the Republicans need to really move ahead in giving us a really complete and better plan than the ACA?
Well, I guess they'll do what they do. When you say they have to, they'll do what they do. I don't, you know, they if they can get the votes for a different path forward, they will. You know, what I'd say about the Affordable Care Act is it did extend coverage to many Americans. But, you know, healthcare costs are a function of, you know, supply and demand, just like in any other realm of the economy. And the Affordable Care Act didn't really do anything to provide incentives to increase the supply of healthcare, which really would come through either better technology, you know, more doctors or more nurses, nor did it do anything to decrease demand. It increased demand by bringing more people into coverage, And, you know, if we had maybe a better system that required, you know, higher copays or higher deductibles with some copay formula, that could at least begin to get people to make, you know, better choices maybe about how much demand to place on healthcare services in the aggregate. But, you know, what we've got now really has driven up the cost a lot. And I'm not saying people shouldn't have coverage, but if you're going to do that, you got to be prepared to write a really big check or make some reforms that get everyone paying more attention and kind of take the average cost down.
You know, Kurt, what do you say about this?
Well, we seem to have the worst of both worlds here. Yes, we do have more people who actually have coverage, but can they afford to access it? Because we have seen deductibles increase, copays increase, coinsurance increase to the point where people don't use the health care that they have because of the costs involved in using it when they need it, when they're sick, which kind of defeats the purpose. I also would argue, you know, it's deceptively named, the Affordable Care Act. It was never really meant to address the cost side. It was designed to address the access side, which arguably it did. Now I think we've got to talk about what can we do to drive down costs, and you know, part of it has to be on the transparency. When I go to the doctor, I don't get a menu of how much it costs, and I think that's a problem because I can't shop. I'm not incentivized to. I think we need to know what the costs are. We need to know what the quality is, and we need to make decisions as consumers and drive down costs that way. Markets work, and it's absent in the healthcare industry right now.
We're going to talk specifically about Wisconsin and the upper Midwest. Michael Knetter had some interesting things to say in that interview in Biz Times that those areas of the Midwest with disenfranchised citizens, the upper Midwest, really gave Donald Trump the presidency. So what can be done to bring back jobs that will help people who are ailing in Wisconsin and Michigan and other parts of the Midwest? Those were the voters who put him over the top. So what can be done to make those people who used to have pretty good jobs happy again and make it a decent living? Our guest this hour, and we're going to be welcoming you to the conversation momentarily, Kurt Bauer, President and CEO of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, Michael Knetter, President and CEO of the University of Wisconsin Foundation. Before that, he was Dean of the Wisconsin School of Business. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network. All right, let's go to phone calls, gentlemen. We start with Nate in Milwaukee. Hello, Nate.
Hi, thank you for having me. I want to mention a couple of things. I'll try to be brief with them, but understandable. I look at the economic future, and I'm of mixed opinion, especially relating to what the guests have brought up. I look at Wisconsin, and under our current state government, WMC's views have been highly privileged, and we've seen a decline in terms of the number of people in the middle class that's well above the average for the rest of the nation. If I look federally, I think we both agree that infrastructure spending would be a good idea. But part of the reason we haven't seen more of that already is because members of his political party were blocking President Obama from spending more on infrastructure, either out of ideology or out of partisanship. For energy, we actually saw state government increasing regulations on renewable to slow potential different types of energy development. I know they would certainly appreciate increased fossil fuel usage, but with global warming, that would be a benefit sooner, but pay increasingly heavy costs later, as that would cause its own economic damage. So I do not see as much upside, though I can see some, and with privatization of, say, roads and stuff like that. They tried that in a road in Indiana, and it didn't work out so well in that it wasn't maintained as much as the purchaser said it would be. and you would essentially be having tolls go to a private company, unlike with public roads having tolls supposedly to maintain that actual road.
Thank you, Nate, for your call. Kurt, to you first.
Sure. Well, there's a lot there. So let me start with the middle class argument that was stated earlier. You know, Wisconsin's doing pretty well, and, you know, there's a I constantly hear that our GDP growth isn't as strong as some other states, but frankly, that's not our biggest issue. Right now, the biggest issue in Wisconsin isn't job growth. It's finding workers for the jobs that we have. We have 70% of our members say they are having trouble finding workers. We've got an aging population. We've got more baby boomers than millennials. We're one of 12 states in that category, which doesn't bode well for us. And we've got to find workers. If you want to have a strong middle class, you need to support manufacturing, and that leads me into the energy component that that Nate mentioned. You can't run a advanced manufacturing-based economy on alternative energies, at least not now. There'll have to be some sort of technological breakthrough on the power density, just how many kilowatts, megawatts you can produce through wind turbines and solar, and then on the storage. You know, for example, this morning driving in, the wind turbines out by my house weren't turning. They're not generating energy. And, you know, they probably were in the evening and you could have maybe captured that, except that the technology doesn't exist. So whether we like it or not, in a manufacturing-intensive economy like we have here in Wisconsin, we need to rely on fossil fuels. Let's see, what else do we have here? Infrastructure. I think I'll let Dr. Knetter address that.
All right. Yeah. And, Michael, let me direct your comments to something you've already said. In that article, you say, to me, the deck feels pretty stacked against Wisconsin. This will speak to some of Nate's points. We do not come across as a state that's focused on developing human capital at the highest level, and that does not make me optimistic for Wisconsin. Hopefully, with this election behind us, we can do better.
Yeah, well, you know, I think Kurt's right. In the short term, you know, it would be nice. You know, one reason for a declining middle class is there's been a lot of stress on the manufacturing sector. That's not unique to Wisconsin, but Wisconsin has a disproportionately high share of jobs in manufacturing. We've done better than most states in retaining manufacturing jobs, actually, a great credit to the companies in our state. But the area of job growth in the country is much more in services than it is in manufacturing per se, and that's not unique to us either. That's been true. That's the national trend, I should say. You know, you see fewer employees as a share of the workforce making stuff, either in agriculture or manufacturing or industry, and that has to do with technological substitution. You know, if you wanted to create a lot more jobs quickly, you'd ban farm equipment, but nobody thinks that's a good idea. So increasingly, you know, you have to prepare a workforce that can compete in some of the high-paying service sector jobs. And we see some of those around the state growing pretty rapidly. You know, here in Madison, American Family Insurance and Epic Systems are two really large employers. They're in services businesses, not manufacturing. And they provide really good jobs. And, you know, and so preparing people for a future of more jobs like that is important. And that's why I think it would be really constructive for us to get a more positive dialogue going on between the university system and the state, or the K-12 system and the state, because, you know, really education is an important part of the economic future of any society.
Kurt, what do you say to that?
Oh, I agree. I think Dr. Kinnegar is right on. I think we need to do a better job of pairing young people who are deciding what careers that they want to pursue with the jobs that we actually have in this economy. We've got 13,000 manufacturing jobs that are right now vacant in this state. Think about what that could mean to our unemployment rate. Think what that could mean to GDP growth, because manufacturing has a multiplier effect you don't see in most other sectors of the economy. For every factory job, you create about 2.5 jobs in other sectors of the economy. So if we can fill manufacturing jobs, you know, that is the foundation of the middle class. You know, what grew a broad middle class in the United States was manufacturing. So we want to stick to that base, but we also want all of the above, as Dr. Knetter mentioned. We also need to expand other sectors as well. And from our perspective, as I said earlier, right now, the number one challenge facing Wisconsin isn't job growth. It's finding people for the jobs we have, and we've got to do a better job of that. And that does take some investment. The governor has invested a lot of money in fast forward grants for the Department of Workforce Investment. We need to do more of those types of things, and we do need a strong partnership with our technical colleges and our university system, both private and public, to make sure that we're grooming people for the careers that we're actually producing.
Mm-hmm. 13,000 manufacturing jobs. What's the problem? People don't have the skills, or what is it?
Well, it's a combination. It's a good question, because we used to call it a skills gap. And frankly, we can solve a skills gap. If you want a job but don't have the skills for it and are ready to learn, we can, you know, we've got an amazing technical college system. We've got a great university system. You know, we've got campuses all over the state, so they're convenient to get to, not to mention online learning. So we can solve the skills gap. We have seen also an enthusiasm gap, meaning that people don't want the jobs that are available. Maybe they have a stigma attached to manufacturing. They see it as dumb, dirty, and dangerous. They don't understand that this is advanced manufacturing. This is high tech. The information age meets the industrial age. And then I think, frankly, the bigger problem for us is the population gap. We just don't have the bodies in Wisconsin. We need to encourage, you know, young people to go into those careers. We need to encourage people to come into Wisconsin, actually.
You've talked about this population problem, that people are heading south. The fastest growing states in the U.S. economy have tended to be in the south, where population has grown faster. Why is the south succeeding here? They lost the war, Michael.
Well, it's just, for the most part, you know, there was a time when the manufacturing economy had to be located near the natural resources that were the ingredients to the products. And so, and also around shipping. So the Great Lakes, with iron ore deposits and things like that around here, the forests that were used by the paper industry, you know, there was a time that, that it made sense for manufacturers to locate here. Well, now most of the pulp product that goes into making paper comes from Brazil, because they have a bit of a comparative advantage in the production of pulp. Trees grow seven times as fast at the equator as they do in northern Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's fundamentally changed the location decision. And then there are other regulatory reasons why, you know, manufacturing has found a friendlier environment in some of the southern states.
Nate, thanks very much for your call. Dave in Madison comments that the baseline on which to judge a president on economic ability should be the first budget plan that they pass. Kurt, you want to comment?
Well, I'm not so sure I share that opinion. I think you judge a president years after they've left office, because it takes that long to understand exactly how their policies have impacted the economy or the world. So I'm not so sure I do that. You know, from my perspective, we're watching very closely the first 100 days, traditionally the period where the new president has a honeymoon period. I'm not so sure this president has a honeymoon period, but to the extent that he does, the first 100 days is when he's going to try and put forward his vision. And, you know, one thing you can say about him, he is doing so far exactly what he said he was going to do. Like it or not, that is what he is doing.
Let's go to Dave in Madison. Hi, Dave.
Yes, hi. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the skills gap and the research that shows that it's not really a question of us in education not training enough people to fit the jobs. Is that the manufacturing jobs in Wisconsin aren't paying enough in wages to attract people to do them. It's not stigma, it's wages. And manufacturers don't want to raise wages because they know once they do, it's much more difficult to cut them back. So if you want to solve the problem, you've got to fill those 13,000 open jobs. Get your members to increase their wages. And, you know, we'll have to see where that goes.
Kurt.
Well, that's not what I'm hearing from the education community, because we've had programs, you know, welding programs that have had to close down in parts of the state because there were not enough students. But, you know, the wages are going up in Wisconsin. You know, wages in manufacturing are going up. And, you know, we talk about whether or not you need a minimum wage or something like that. What I say is that, look, bottom line is that if you're willing to work, if you're drug-free, if you can learn a new skill, probably on the job, but perhaps through a technical college, and if you're willing to move an hour from where you currently live or so, we can find you a job in this state in manufacturing making at least $14 an hour with benefits, more if you're willing to work the second or third shift. And obviously that is a middle-class wage. That is something that you can raise a family on and you can grow into. So I think that there are jobs out there. And, you know, I've heard this wage argument. I just don't see it. We're seeing our wages going up because businesses are being are forced to be very competitive. They're doing all the things that you'd expect them to do. They're raising wages. They're increasing their packages. They're also doing a lot of automation. But on the other side, they're also doing some things that we don't like seeing. They're delaying expansions. They're outsourcing most likely out of state. So they're doing some things that ultimately long-term hurt Wisconsin.
Hmm. Michael, your response to that?
I think, you know, Kurt hits it pretty well. And the caller has a fair point. I mean, you know, if people aren't taking the jobs, one way to make them more attractive is to pay more. But, of course, companies face competition, and so they're only able to pay, you know, what they can afford to based on the market conditions that they face. So, but, you know, there are always circumstances where people, you know, maybe they don't have the information they need. Maybe they need to consider moving if that's possible. So, you know, there are ways to make the market perhaps function better, and I'm sure WMC is trying to do that, but there's no magic bullet there.
Let me go back to this area of finding perhaps jobs that we haven't thought very much about before. You remind us that we've lost manufacturing jobs, and it might be Pollyannish to think about those manufacturing, good-paying, really good-paying, family-supporting jobs coming back to the upper Midwest, to places like Wisconsin. Some manufacturing jobs may return to the U.S., and you say, Michael, that you don't see them coming to northern states in large numbers. So there's an uncertainty about what policymakers are promoting as our source of growth in the future. What is our source of growth?
Well, you know, that's always the amazing thing about capitalism, I guess. So forever, you know, we've always feared that, you know, whether it's trade or technology is somehow going to create a circumstance where there's just going to be this massive unemployment. And, you know, apart from a couple of big periods in our history, like the Great Depression, and I wouldn't say that was caused by technology, we haven't had those periods in capitalist economies. We always adjust. But you can almost never predict exactly where the job growth is going to occur. You know, that's the other thing about it. So you can kind of see in some cases where you're going to be losing jobs because of automation, but it's hard to see what jobs will take their place. But somehow, if you look back through history at how many people are employed as a share of the working age population in our economy, it's remarkably stable. But I do think, you know, there's this feeling that the upper Midwest is kind of owed something, and it's going to be difficult to deliver that. You know, at the margin, things could get a little better in manufacturing, I suppose, if we stop the flow of goods from Mexico to the U.S. Let's imagine we slap a 20% tariff on imports from Mexico. Are we going to start making those same goods here? Well, maybe some of them. We might import them from somewhere else, though. And some of those goods are agricultural products like
yes.
ripe tomatoes that
mm-hmm.
we get in the winter that we aren't going to be making here. And even if we grow them in the summer, there are a lot of places where you can't find people to pick them at competitive prices. So, you know, I think Trump's attempt to do some saber rattling on trade is designed to create at least some sense that he's looking out for workers who might feel like they lost their jobs to trade. But I think even if we slow down or reverse trade to some extent, it's not going to put a big dent in the number of manufacturing jobs, especially in the upper Midwest. Because like I said, to some degree, those may end up locating in the South. You know, we aren't just going to restart factories that were closed 10 years ago. That's not going to happen. It would be perhaps a new factory would be built, and the question is where would that happen?
Right.
So I'm very nervous about the president's current stance on trade. I think he's making that a bigger culprit, and it actually delivers a lot of benefits to people. And the other thing he's doing is intruding on specific companies kind of on a one-by-one basis and kind of admonishing them to change their investment plans, shifting capital back home. I don't know what is entailed in those negotiations, but, you know, that's not going to be good for the return on capital for those companies. And so that will end up hurting the stock market, at least for companies in the affected industries. And, you know, it's hard for a president to get involved in that level of detail. I wish the president would focus on the changes he'd like to make in the rules, and then, because companies aren't going to like that uncertainty. Mm-hmm. They'd like to have a certain rule-based, law-based environment that we're all going to play by. And you don't want to change that too often. You know, a new president, maybe we'll make some changes, but it's hard to find the example of the country who found a great path to prosperity by rejecting trade.
Mm, interesting. Kurt, what do you think is Wisconsin's future growth possibility?
Well, I'm very bullish on Wisconsin. You're right. We have had negative out-migration since, I believe, 2008. But I do think we have an opportunity to reverse that, that stream. You know, you look at what's going on in Illinois. In October, Southern Illinois University did a scientific poll and showed 47% of people living there were interested in maybe moving someplace else. I say come north. I think it's an opportunity for us to gain population, which will help us grow our economy. You don't have GDP growth without population growth, and that's a real threat for Wisconsin right now. And you know, we've seen jobs come across the border already from a variety of different sectors, but I wouldn't also discount manufacturing. It's 20% of our economy right now. Like I said, it is the foundation of the middle class. I don't think we want to retreat from it. Dr. Kinnetter is absolutely right that, you know, when you've got these manufacturing clusters, that they are by and large around either transportation hubs or raw materials. But today, they're centered around the supply chain. And in the upper Midwest, we have the best supply chain in the industrial world. So if you've got industry here, it begets more industries to provide suppliers, vendors into that supply chain. So I think that there's an opportunity to grow manufacturing, but I think there's an opportunity to grow other sectors as well. I'm very bullish on Wisconsin. I think we just need to make sure that we market ourselves. So being the best kept secret in the upper Midwest isn't doing very well for us. We need to market our quality of life, our great schools, our great community, the job opportunities we have, and we can get people to move here. But it won't happen unless we market ourselves.
We're going to continue taking phone calls in a moment. We're looking at the optimism that is present among many business leaders in the country with the rhetoric and some of the initial actions by President Donald Trump. We're looking at the Midwest specifically and Wisconsin even more specifically to look at the jobs of the future and growth industries of the future that will be attractive to people and get more of them to move here. And we're looking at the wages and trade. We got a lot of things on the plate this hour. We have two guests with us. Michael Kinnetter is the president and CEO of the University of Wisconsin Foundation. Prior to that, he was dean of the Wisconsin School of Business. He also served as senior staff economist for the President's Council of Economic Advisors for former Presidents George Herbert Walker Bush and Bill Clinton. Kurt Bauer, president and CEO of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, representing 3,800 employers of all sizes and from every sector of the economy. Before that, he spent 18 years working for financial industry trade groups, including CEO for both the Wisconsin and Arizona Bankers Associations. More phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network. Let's go to Richard next in Madison. Hello, Richard.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Good, quite well, thank you. I was just wondering about a couple questions. The talk about infrastructure development, I'm wondering specifically kind of what areas they're talking about, because in traveling through the state and through the country over the last few years, 5 years or more, I mean, there's so much work done on bridges, on federal interstate highways, and airports have received money and stuff like that. So I'm just curious to hear what additional infrastructure spending is being spoken about in general. And the other question I have is in regards to, you know, like 13,000 manufacturing jobs. This is obviously something that's happened not over the last month, but it's happened over the, you know, the last, you know, quite a few years. And doesn't that warrant the federal backing and some of the state backing, as was kind of mentioned, as far as education and ability, getting people to match up with jobs a little bit better? And lastly, there was a really interesting piece, I think, on 60 Minutes about a town in Mississippi or an area of Mississippi where they marketed so well that they've had so many businesses come in. So maybe that's the type of thing that we need to, given that our industrial base is a much, much older base than some of these things that are being set up down south that are, you know.
Thank you very much for the call. Kurt, you want to start?
Yeah, the last part of what he said kind of broke up. I don't know if you heard it, Kathleen, but maybe you can help me with
it. It was
that
a 60-minute. I don't remember the piece, although he made me think that maybe we should do something on this. Mississippi did something to attract new kinds of business. It was on 60 Minutes. I didn't see that piece, so we'll
no,
just
nor
get
did
that.
I. Mississippi has been very aggressive in creating incentives to move jobs down there. There's no doubt about that, and that's something that we've tried to work on here in Wisconsin. We have something called the Manufacturers and Agriculture Production Tax Credit that allows for businesses to zero out or basically zero out their corporate tax liability for production that they can show here in Wisconsin. It's a huge incentive, and it's very similar to what they've done in New York, which is controlled by Democrats under Governor Cuomo, to basically zero out their corporate tax rate for manufacturers in order to induce that kind of economic activity in their state. So, you know, that Mississippi has done things like that. Other states have. Wisconsin has been slow, I think, to respond, but I think that we are responding, and it makes us more competitive. On the education side, we have been trying to work with the K-12s to bring back what, you know, we used to call the industrial arts. Many schools have brought them back or are revamping them. Some of the schools around the state have had antiquated systems and antiquated machinery. They're spending money and they're working with local manufacturers to get you know, the machines that they need to train people for the jobs that are in manufacturing today. We need to do more of that. We have a great relationship with the technical college system as well, and we've been working very closely with the university system and the private colleges and universities on that as well. On the infrastructure side of things, I'm not sure what President Trump may want to do. During the campaign, he talked a lot about bridges, ports, airports, and highways, but the specifics just aren't out there as far as I can tell.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's operating at rapid neck speed, so I would imagine you'll hear more about that pretty shortly. Michael, you want to respond to what Richard covered?
You know, I think Kurt hit on all the high points. You know, one thing I'd like to just add, Kathleen, if you don't mind,
of course.
I think focusing too much on total job growth and population growth in Wisconsin may not serve us as well as focusing on the average quality of jobs and quality of life we provide here. You know, one of the things that can make the state a more attractive place for workers and companies is if the northern part of the state were to flourish even more as an area of high-quality tourism.
Mm.
So, you know, I'm not sure that I always want to have a lot more people moving to Wisconsin, but I want to have better jobs for the people we do have.
Mm-hmm. This is an interesting figure. Tell me what you both think about this, Kurt, you first. Patrick sends this email. It's not clear to me that a family can move to another part of the state for less than $30,000 and consider themselves middle class. What do you think, Kurt?
Well, it depends on where they're moving from, and it depends on what type of job they're going to be getting. But, I mean, I will tell you that, you know, I think The five counties with the highest unemployment in the state are in northern Wisconsin. There aren't a lot of jobs up there. And, you know, we can work on tourism, as Dr. Kinetter just mentioned. You know, we tried to site an iron ore mine, which would have created thousands of very high-paying jobs. That didn't work. It's tough. So we've got to try and move people where the jobs are. And that's easy to say, of course, because, you know, people have mortgages, they have kids in school, they've got parents that they have to take care of that might be aging. So I understand all of that. But the reality is that we do have good-paying jobs in pockets of the state, but not everywhere in the state. We're unique. We're different than, say, Illinois or Minnesota. most of our population isn't concentrated in our metro area like it is in Chicago or the Twin Cities. We have population dispersed, which I think creates an advantage for us. I mean, we've got great communities, but it is a challenge for job creation.
Let's go next. Thanks, Richard, to Nancy in Grafton. Hi, Nancy.
Well, good afternoon. It's starting to snow here in Grafton.
I know. It is here, too, in Milwaukee.
Well, anyhow, what I wanted to say was I wanted to know what their opinion was of union labor and the jobs in the future, because my son, Mike Knetter, is a union steward in Milwaukee, or not a steward, he's a foreman, and my grandson is a foreman, and my husband worked for union for many years, and he's retired now, but we get insurance, we get a pension. Just what the heck is the matter that we don't have more union work? And I don't like to see it go to private corporations making money off of people. I think we need a return to the union workers.
Michael, what do you say?
Well, the union jobs that we had in the past, and my father had one, so I grew up in a household. My dad ran a machine in a paper mill. They were good jobs, and they paid well. The forces of competition made it hard to sustain the level of pay and benefits that some of the unions were providing. And that's why some of the factory production moved to other states whose average pay wasn't quite as high or benefit loads weren't quite as heavy as you found here. And so that's something that would have to play out in the political dynamic of the state. Obviously we seem to be going more in the other direction to some degree. But that is driven by forces of competition. And, you know, for people who couldn't get a union job, those union jobs weren't as helpful because maybe everything you had to buy was a little more expensive because of it too. So at the end of the day, we need to train people to have the skills that enable them to add value in an economy at a level that gets for them a living or middle class wage. And, there's kind of no shortcuts to that. And I think, that's the hard work that we have to do as a state, is get people prepared for the economy that we live in today, mm-hmm. which is a little different.
And it's one of the things that the new president has promised that he'll do for people in this area, part of the country, and in other parts, too. His presidency, well, who knows where his presidency is going? It's something different every day, certainly. But he has promised that he'll do something for those very workers who voted for him and put him over the top. So he has to deliver, right, Kurt?
Yeah, he will. It's interesting to watch, but specific to the caller's question about unions, I agree with Dr. Knetter. I think return on investment for a union membership needs to be there. And many of the very successful unions nationally here in Wisconsin provide training and placement services. If they continue to show that kind of value to their members, they'll grow their membership. Last week, I think we saw, a story that showed that union membership in Wisconsin has declined. That doesn't have to be the case as long as they're providing some sort of tangible benefit to their members.
And let's take one final call. Steve in West Bend. There we go. Sorry. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
This goes back earlier in your conversation, about 20 minutes ago. I didn't get to the beginning of it, but talking about the Medicare and the health situation, I can attest to I've had a kidney transplant from polycystic kidneys probably 14 years ago, and my prescriptions, and I speak pretty positive of the Medicare system. You definitely need your supplemental plan, but I have a plan that you can find for $150, and they all meet these guidelines, and the lesser expensive ones can be very favorable. Mm-hmm. I do have a complaint about people that wear a lot of CPAP machines, which I've also had 25 years, and, Afria, which is a national company, I get calls monitored probably every 2 to 3 months, and they want to keep sending you more supplies, and they ask you, if you have any left. Well, a lot of people probably say they don't when they do, and, it's like these things add up to replaceable face masks or the heating.
Yeah, I'm sure they do, and Steve, we're out of time. That's another whole conversation is healthcare, and we've been having that conversation for years here on this program, and I guess we'll continue. Gentlemen, thank you very much. It was a wide-ranging and interesting conversation. We appreciate your time and your thoughts. Thanks, Michael.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kurt. Michael Knetter, President and CEO of the University of Wisconsin Foundation. Kurt Bauer, President and CEO of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. It was interesting, wasn't it? I can't hear what you're saying, but yeah, it was an interesting hour. Thanks so much to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, to Colleen Duvall for on-air production here in Milwaukee, and thanks for your contributions. If you didn't make it on the air, go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, because I'm serious. We read all your comments, and we like to do just that. We'll be with you again tomorrow.